Hey, what's going on, you filthy animals? Welcome back to another episode. Sorry, it's been about a week and a half since I dropped the last episode. You know, I've been so busy with the Instagram and all my other profiles that I have a lot more activity ongoing right now. And for me, you know, the podcast, I just kind of fell back behind a little bit. This is episode 41, so I've been burning them out quite a bit. And I just got a little tired, and I had a lot of stuff going on in Ventura. You guys following me, you know, on social media, Twitter, Instagram, you name it. No, you know, I do commercial real estate. I'm starting to get into that. So I had some business down there, some deals I'm working. I won't get into what exactly I'm doing yet, because I will talk about that on a later podcast. I will say these deals are quite interesting. It is definitely out of the box type thinking, which I like. And could prove to be pretty lucrative. I'm fairly excited about it, but you guys know I still love this community. And if I had to choose between doing real estate or shooting the shit with you guys for a living, you guys know what I would do. But anyways, without further ado, I had Michael Harris back on the podcast. You guys know him. He's of Iron Oak Wealth out of Austin. I went to school with him. He's been on the podcast a couple of times. He works for a registered investment advisor, and he's been in this advisory space for the last, God, 3 or 4 years. Really bright guy, just a fantastic man to talk to when it comes to markets. He's logical. He's also an out-of-the-box thinker, but he's just, again, someone that you want to listen to. So when you see a podcast with this man on it, make sure you subscribe, make sure you download it, make sure you share it with your friends and family. Without further ado, I hope you guys enjoy the episode.
What's a hard money like loan compared to like a regular one?
Yeah. So, and this is, I'm going to start recording because I want people to hear this. You know, people are quick to blame the financial markets. They're quick to blame the big banks. I think what's really criminal are like the interest rates that credit card companies and these lenders can get away with charging. It's absolutely fucking outrageous. So it's against the law myself to hard money lend past usually 10 to 12% interest rate.
Okay.
Well, you know what these credit card companies get away with, or these loan sharks, they get away with tons, you know, 20, 30, 40%. So that right away, it's just outrageous. But hard money essentially is this idea that, especially in like the real estate community, when you're like closing escrow on flips, it's hard to get traditional financing. So you go to like me to float you a note. So I'm doing one right now. It's like 35 grand. So it's not a big deal. You float at a 10% interest rate, and you might pay like a point or two for an origination fee. And you float that for like 3 or 4 months while they're doing the renovation on the flip. Then you get paid back. So I'm hopefully that one gets going for me, but hard money is an interesting space.
Okay. Makes sense. Yeah, man. I always like look at credit card companies and like the interest rates are insane. I know you had somebody recently on talking about credit cards. Which, like, I'll talk to people about credit cards like all day. That's more like personal finance stuff, right? Compared to like an RIA. Like, nobody comes to me and it's like, hey, like, what's the best credit card to get?
Yeah, exactly. I don't fucking know, man.
Yeah. You just got to be careful, like, opening them up and like closing them. And like, if you're trying to apply for a loan, that's always what I like tell people. I'm like, hey, like, just take it easy when it comes to credit cards and obviously like pay them off. But you don't necessarily have to like close them, but. Yeah, it's that's kind of like a whole nother world, but I love looking at like credit card deals and travel points and whatnot. I just like opened a Amex Gold and I was like, yeah, I'm pretty good on here for a while and I'm traveling enough to like justify another one. Did you say what are you rocking now?
So I have like two, and apparently my dumbass chose the best cards on the market. Apparently, that's what they told me. I have the Chase Sapphire. And then the Chase Freedom.
Okay. Did you get, you don't have the reserve, you just have the sapphire?
Yeah.
It's nice. Yeah, those are solid cards for me.
Oh, yeah.
Fuck. I understand. I was between the Chase Reserve and then the Amex Gold. I was just like, eh. I'll just Amex Gold. Just why not? I'll do it. Looks good.
What's the annual fee on that?
$250, but you get $120 to Uber, and you get another $120. I think it's to DoorDash. Which, oh.
So it's like if you use it, and I don't know about you, but like,
you pay like
I
10 bucks
shit every year.
Yeah, absolutely.
Yeah, that's good. Well, so what's going on, man? How are things in your world right now since we last talked? How are your clients doing? Man. How are your portfolios looking?
Yeah, man. Being in the innovation space obviously has not been the best these past couple months, but it always like goes back to the fundamentals of the company and the vision of the company. Where, you know, do you actually believe in what this company is doing? Do you think they have a runway to do what they say they're going to do? So those are the questions that we like continue to ask. And as long as the answer is yes, then it's like, okay, well, a few, you know, three or four rocky months, we look like, when we look back on average, it's going to be a blip on the radar, right? Sure. 10 years from now,
sure.
Again, if these companies are able to do what they say they're going to do,
yep.
Who cares if there's like a 10, 15% drawdown or even more. Whenever hopefully they're able to like do maybe 3x their size,
right? Yeah, and those drawdowns were driven by like a larger shift in the market that isn't necessarily just to one single company,
right? For sure. Yeah. And then you see what's really perplexing right now is as earnings are coming out, you're seeing companies like crushing earnings, beating expectations. Like Google was a huge surprise. Like Google, Microsoft, their overhead isn't crazy compared to the amount of revenue that they bring in.
Right.
But in some cases, like Google, you see their stock continue to go up. Same thing with Amazon.
Oh yeah.
Love Amazon, right? How do you not like Amazon? You can always justify putting like 4 or 5% of every portfolio that's growth oriented in Amazon, Google, whatever.
Apple. I mean, all those big five, man, they crushed it.
Right. Yeah. And I was having the discussion today, like you look at those companies and, you know, we were talking about the Berkshire, you know, meeting, and obviously Berkshire is basically a mutual fund within a stock.
Yeah.
If you look at
those
companies, they're essentially the same thing. You look at their revenue stream, you look at what they're doing and how they're expanding. It's essentially like owning three or four companies within one single company.
Yeah.
Even more in some cases. So, yeah. But again, like we're seeing these companies come out, crush earnings, beat expectations, and then some continue to go up and then some get crushed. Like Microsoft came out and their guidance going forward wasn't as bullish as people wanted. And so you see the stock drop, I think maybe down like 5-10%. I don't monitor it super closely. But they still beat earnings, right? Speaking of Microsoft, you see Bill Gates and Melinda Gates are getting a divorce?
No. Are you serious?
Yeah, dude. They just broke 10 minutes ago.
Shut the fuck up. What?
Dude, yeah. that is no! Crazy.
Dude. Yeah.
Yeah. I don't know why, but I saw that. I was like, holy cow. But
whoa,
it's crazy.
Uh-oh. Is he pulling a Jeff Bezos? Did he find himself a hot new honey?
Dude, I don't know, but Jeff Bezos is rocking that like old man, like dad kind of look with the shaved head.
He's
got the aviators, like the sweater vest. And he's buff. Like,
so you know Jeff Bezos is on HGH or something.
Oh, for sure. Yeah, him and Joe Rogan could hang out and like they'd be best friends, you know?
Oh, man. Dude, so it's interesting. That's
Bill crazy, Gates man. Doesn't really have that going for him, you know?
No. You know, so it's interesting. You know, you kind of talked about innovation and like literally in the last year, I felt like a lot of money was in this like negative growth space, right? Where people didn't care about growth or they didn't care about, you know, they didn't care about earnings. Like negative earnings was fine.
Oh, for sure.
You know, it didn't matter. And so now I'm kind of curious as we're seeing, you know, these companies that we know, you know, these top five, you know, your Googles, your Apples. I wonder if that's going to change the tide. You know, I know we've already started a shift to value, but I'm curious to see if innovation is going to continue to struggle as we see, you know, there's still kind of a safe haven, so to speak, in these big tech names.
Yeah. I've heard the argument of, and I think we might have talked about this the last time we were on the podcast, so I apologize for reiterating, but a lot of people are saying like the big five, if you will, like they are essentially bonds in a portfolio now.
Yes.
Where people are like putting money into it. That's so right. You're seeing like 20-25% of a portfolio in either Alphabet, Apple, Microsoft, Google, or excuse me, Alphabet and Google is the same thing. I mean, Amazon. I can't stress enough, like that is not smart when it comes to having like a safe haven of a portfolio. Yeah, I think those companies are still going to continue to grow and continue to excel in what they're doing.
Right.
You have bonds in a portfolio for one purpose and one purpose only, and that is for that safety net in case the market does crash. Because, I mean, look at Apple. Apple has basically been steady all year, right?
Yeah.
S&P's up, NASDAQ's up, Dow Jones is up.
Yeah.
Which is, I think Dow Jones is outperforming, right?
Yeah.
Last time I checked.
Dow Jones, yep.
Which is, I don't remember the last time we can say that, right? Mm-mm. Like that's pretty crazy.
Not in the last decade, absolutely not.
If your safe haven is still performing like 10% every year,
right?
It's probably a pretty risky safe haven, in my opinion. Like for me and my clients, like if they're in a conservative portfolio and what's considered safe is still like the beta or much it fluctuates, right, you're going to get like 10 to 15%. That's not very safe in my opinion. Like I would feel a lot safer with it being anywhere from 4 to 6%, which out loud, you sound like an idiot, right? But I guarantee you last March, last April, people were very happy that they were in those safe havens. So, you know, it really does come down to kind of portfolio construction and what you're comfortable with. And that's why, shameless plug, right? What I do, meeting with somebody and really understanding your risk tolerance and how you view money, that's where it really comes into play and where it helps having an advisor or having a better understanding of your investments.
You know, it's funny you mentioned that, like, you know, there's so many studies out there that track the hot stocks in a decade. And then I'm sure you know, these hot stocks tend to underperform in the decades after, you know, and that's quite common what you see. I mean, there's so many cases out there, survivorship bias, where that's the case. But it's hard to not want to invest in these companies. When I was reading last year, 2020, 44% of the S&P 500 gain was due to those five companies. 40, you know, because it's just like, you know, it's like a positive skew in the market's positive skew, right? So there's just there's a small amount of winners that make up such a large portion of the gain in the overall market. Which is why like individual stock picking is like finding a needle in a haystack, except in this case.
So, in the Berkshire annual meeting, Warren Buffett pulls up a page and it's the top 20 companies by market cap in 1989. And you know how many are still on that list?
Probably one or two.
I think it was zero. I genuinely think it was zero. And you know, it's you know, shameless plug for America. I love America. I know you love America. So,
yeah, so do
that's
I.
Great.
I love it.
Back in the day, you know, 20, 30 years ago, there were only a handful of companies that were American. And now we look at the top 5 out of 6 and they're American. So
yeah.
Say what you will about this country, but man, it is there's definitely a lot of I guess runway when building a company. The fact that even some of these companies weren't even around 20, 30 years ago, and now they're at the top, making up 5 of the 6 top companies in the world. So by market cap size, right?
You know, I'd be curious to know, like, you know, I would typically be scared shitless because, like, the survivorship bias is a real thing. But I don't know, correct me if I'm wrong, I don't know if we've ever had companies this large that have such a dominating market share. And so for me, it's like, you know, are these companies going to be around for a decade, 2 decades? I mean, the market's so dynamic and changing every day, but it's hard to make the case that these are going away anytime soon.
Yeah, I actually had that same thought process or yeah, that same thought process, I guess that's the right way to say it.
Yeah.
But while listening to the meetings, it was like, all right, we see Apple, we see Microsoft, we see Google, Saudi Arabia's, that's the number two in the world behind Apple. It's like, man, what's it going to look like 20 and 30 years from now? And you know, we'll probably look like idiots with what we're saying, right?
Right.
But long haul, kind of doing what you're saying following what you're saying and doing what you're doing, like, can't really go wrong when it comes to being diversified across the board. And I know you wanted to talk about that today.
Yeah.
So we can kind of segue into that if you want.
Yeah. Yeah. So what there's so much to talk about. Oh my God.
Yeah.
Well, I was reading an article, The Resurgence of Active Trading. I was listening to a podcast, Animal Spirits, and they were talking about like the new retail trader like Robinhood, and how, you know, until now they really haven't had a dominating presence in the market, and they're still like market share, they're really small, but right, the volatility that's driven by these retail is like exponentially higher. And so I'm curious what your thoughts are on this like new active Robinhood trader who clearly is more overconfident, because we as Americans, you know, we live in the best country in the world, or that's at least what we tell ourselves. I'm curious what do you think the impact is going to be on the institutional side? How's that going to impact you guys?
Yeah, it's a very interesting time, right? Because in one way, I'm really happy that people are able to get into the market, right? I think Robinhood's main thing was that they wanted to knock down the barrier to entry. And now we see that with like Charles Schwab, TD Ameritrade, where there's free trades, right?
Everywhere.
Honestly, if like $5 was really affecting what you were going to do, chances are like you probably shouldn't have been trading that much anyway. But now that it's free, you know, quote unquote free, right? I don't think people understand like how much money companies are making on the back end with the amount of trading that's going on.
The bid ass spread. People are like, dude. Yeah, it's free.
Yeah, it's free to you, but yeah, you're making like a quarter of a cent every trade. You're making a lot of money in the long run. You know?
Hell yes.
But anyway, what's going to affect me? And this is something that I encourage with people is like, if you want to trade, go ahead and trade, right? As long as you're taking care of your 401k, you're not putting money that you would necessarily like put into retirement,
right,
into your Robinhood account and like day trading it, like go ahead and trade, because real fast you're going to learn if you like trading or if you don't. So, most of the time what happens is people figure out, you know, 2 or 3 months, and I've had people come and talk to me where it's, we have that conversation. We say, hey, I'm thinking about opening up a Robinhood. You know, I can make a lot of money on GameStop or AMC or Dogecoin or like whatever it is right now. I won't get you started on that yet. But people come, they'll go trade, and then a few months later, they'll come back and say, hey, I realize that's not for me. I want somebody who does this for a living to manage it for me. So I would just want you to take it over. You know,
right.
Very rarely, or not, I guess not very rarely, but that does happen.
Right.
And I think it's just a really good way of kind of measuring how involved you want to be, because you can make it as a day trader, right? 10% of people do.
Somebody's they make it from day trading, or do they make it from selling courses that, you know, they give the impression that they're making it from day trading?
I'll let you tackle that one, because I know that's
your favorite subject. That's awesome.
Yeah. From my side of things, like people just figure out, you know, do I want to be as involved with this, or do I want to have somebody else do it, or do I just want to put it in, you know, index funds and let it ride? And
right.
I'm sure you've seen that CFA Institute study of 2013, I believe, where it talks about the most important thing when it comes to investing is not necessarily the security when you're looking at like index funds and, you know, like I'm going to pay 5 basis points or 4.
Yep.
Like only if you have like $1 billion is it really going to matter.
Yeah.
A few basis points in the long haul, but what matters most is asset allocation. So as long as you have your asset allocation in the right spot,
right,
and definition of that is Josh and I are both young. A portfolio we could probably be okay with would be 95% in stocks, 5% in bonds.
Yep.
Honestly, like I'm 100% in growth stocks because, you know,
to the moon, stocks. To the moon, baby.
That's right. Yeah, yeah. If I choose it, it can't go down, right?
Yeah.
So asset allocation means as you get closer and closer to retirement, you're going to de-risk your portfolio, move some of the money that is in stocks. You're going to slowly trickle it into bonds so it gets safer and safer. That way, if you hit 65, 70, you want to retire, hopefully before, as you get closer and closer to retirement, if something like last March happens, not up a creek without a paddle, right? Like you don't lose 40% of your portfolio overnight. And then you have to work, you know, 4 or 5 more years to make that up.
Right. Do you see de-risking changing? Because typically when you hear de-risking, it means get rid of equities. But as bonds have been subpar, are there other ways to de-risk your portfolio? Are you guys getting more into option? Or would you like consider, I don't know, selling options? Are there other ways to generate income that don't include, you know what I mean? Because like de-risking, that's a tough one right now. Because it's like when you get older, you know, de-risking, yeah, you know, you get rid of equities, but there's still that shortfall risk, especially right now with fixed income where it's like, well, shit, you're earning almost nothing. So it's like, how do you balance that expectation?
Yeah, so the conversation we have with clients is, so you're getting close to retirement, right? We're in a bond market right now. You're not going to get anything, right?
Yeah.
Bond yields are so low. I mean, you might be able to get something. If we're talking about individual bonds, it might be 30 years out. You can get, I haven't even checked recently. I have no idea what
high yield, you could probably get 4 to 6%.
Right. So we have that conversation where do we want to put it in ETFs, like something that tracks the ag, maybe government. I use a lot of the GOVT from iShares.
Yep. Nice.
In portfolios. It's safe. You're not going to see a ton of volatility in it, fairly low beta. But again, like it's going to do what it's supposed to do, right?
Right.
Be a safety net. I say that, but I think over the past year, like it hasn't performed super well. I haven't checked recently, but with falling interest rates, that's what's to be expected about any bond ETF.
Right.
So the conversation that we have with clients is, all right, so we can't really get yield from bonds. So what's our other option? Yeah, you could technically do options. We're long everything in our portfolio. And so what we want to do is find stocks with low beta. Obviously, past results don't indicate anything in the future. But historically, if it's had low beta, probably going to be low beta going forward. And so we'll play off of that. We'll put people in something that's paying a solid dividend, huge spreadsheets, and let them realize that, yes, we are taking on some risk here. Hopefully, we're getting anywhere from like 2 to 5% dividend payment.
Right.
And then as bond yields get more attractive, we'll slowly start moving money into them. But for the time being, it's just in safe companies, right?
Yeah. Like
Coca-Cola is an example. We talked about that.
Yep.
Just 2 podcasts ago. Like the beta is so low on Coca-Cola. You know, it's because values had a really great run up the past couple of months.
Sure.
It's performed well, but you look at a 5 to 10 year timeline and you know it's underperformed the S&P, which when you want something safe, that's a great example of something that you
right.
want. Right. Yeah.
Well, yeah, people are always chasing the, you know, to maximize return, but that's not necessarily the goal for every security in an asset allocation. You know what I mean? And that's where people kind of get disconnected. You know, so in this world of, you know, I just feel like you got all these centralized communities. And what I mean by that is, you know, a few years ago, you know, we had like the resurgence of Discord channels, YouTube, you know, group chats and all that stuff. And now it's becoming more centralized, like Wall Street's Bets, Stock Tweets, all that stuff. What are the risks that you see when these groups are becoming more centralized? What are you most worried about?
What am I most worried about when we look at like Wall Street Bets, Stock Twits? I mean, even Yahoo Finance, right? You can go on the boards and I was looking at Clover Health the other day. Just every now and then I'll read the comments.
Yeah.
And people are saying, like, hold the moon. Like, oh, it's going to go, keep going up. I'm like, this is not Wall Street Bets. Like, I don't know what you're saying. And they're like, Moth had our back whenever GameStop was going up. Now we've got to have his. I was like, Shamoth does not care about you. I just want to let you know that. Like, his first thought probably isn't like the Wall Street Bet people. But something that is alarming when it comes to the centralization of information is people are going to be taking on way more risk than they actually sign up for. And I think you would agree with that too, right? I feel like everybody has a story. They're like, well, a family friend told me to buy this stock and I'm just going to do it. Where you hear like, oh, well, like so-and-so really knows what they're doing when it comes to stocks. I'm going to listen to what they have to say. And it's like, what are their qualifications? And also, like, if they told you to jump off a bridge, would you jump off a bridge?
They made money. Like, they made money in 2020. Of course they're an expert. What do you mean?
Yeah, right. So that would probably be my biggest concern. And Warren Buffett addressed this in the annual shareholder meeting. And sorry for referencing it so much. I listened to it today.
So no, it's good. Everyone's been talking about it. I want to touch on it.
Of mine. But he talks about how when you look at the stock market as a casino, that's when things are really risky, right? Like, you can make money in a casino, but at the end of the day, the house is gonna win.
The house is designed.
That's why
win.
Casinos.
Yeah.
Right. 100%. No matter what you play, no matter how smart you are when it comes to blackjack, whatever, like craps, roulette, you're gambling.
And I think
how you view a portfolio.
Yeah. And I think the house in this scenario isn't the market itself. I think it's the psychology of all these new investors, which we all know. You know, what these habits, what they will resort back to. They have weak hands. So I think the house in this situation is the very psychology of these investors. At least that's my opinion.
Yeah. Yeah, yeah. And Warren Buffett also addressed the fact that whenever the bottom falls out, you know who the biggest losers are going to be? They're going to be the retail investors. Nobody's going to tell them that's coming. It's just going to happen. And they're just going to be stuck there holding the bag until... I mean, you can hold the bag until something drops 80-90% and then sell out, or you can hold on to it long term, but it's gonna be pretty bad for retail investors, I think, long term.
I'm curious to see if, like, how, because for so long, you know, my man like Jack Bogle of Vanguard, you know, they revolutionized the space to really design it so the house wasn't always winning, but now it's like this shift to active. I wonder if that's gonna be a place in every retail portfolio. So instead of being like, you know, just heavily indexed in ETFs, maybe you have stocks, bonds, and then an active portion of your portfolio. And that's like just everyday life now. Everyone's going to have that small piece there. I mean, I don't know. Do you have that in your portfolio? I'm assuming.
When it comes to active versus passive?
Yeah.
Give me like 2 seconds, dude. My dog's like freaking out.
No worries.
Out right now.
No worries. Hey guys, so having a good conversation so far. I hope you guys are enjoying this one. You know, it's one of those things right now. I've gotten so much heat talking about like this groupthink theory that I've been seeing. It's not just in the crypto space, but the crypto space is really, really scaring me right now. And I know Michael and I were probably going to talk about it. You know, some of my content has been kind of focused on crypto, not because I'm necessarily a big believer, but I'm trying to help people who are hearing information from one side of the fence. And there's not a whole lot of content out there that's talking about the other side. But just be careful. Michael, now that Michael's back, let's pick up where we left off on the...
All right, sorry about that.
No worries.
Good old Draco.
No worries.
Thought he'd be fine for a little bit, but
no, you're
good. A little restless. I've been in the office all day, and I was like, I'll come home and do the podcast.
No worries, man.
All right, where were we?
We were talking about the shareholder meeting of buff it and just kind of
viewing the stock market as a lottery.
Yes.
Right. I'm gonna put money in, it's always gonna go up. And I think there's a lot of disinformation out there. Like, you look at who's the Barstool guy?
Portnoy.
Yeah. So he's like, you just hold on to stocks for like ever and they'll go up.
You hear that a lot. Dude. And that's not a thing. Because there's survivorship bias.
Not the case.
Right. Because there's so many stocks that aren't that get delisted or what have you. People don't know that. That's misleading.
And everybody you ever run into in exactly the same way. Like, exactly the same way when it comes to this. But you're only going to talk about the stocks that do really well, not the stocks that you lose a lot of money on, you know?
Yep. People don't. That is a real bias there for you guys listening. And look up the survivorship bias. That is absolutely one of the biggest pitfalls in all these studies or all this information that's being spread out there. They don't consider that. And it's not as easy to make money from active management as you might think.
Yeah. Even Warren Buffett, and he pulled up a list of our companies in 1929.
Yeah.
And he only pulled up the ones that started with MA. Just MA, like the first two letters started with MA. And it was like 40 companies. And they weren't even on the New York Stock Exchange or anything like that. But companies go through so many cycles. And whatever you think the next big thing is, choosing that next big thing is extremely difficult. Now we look back, I mean, you can look at 2008, 2009, how many car companies were left?
Three
major ones in America.
Yeah.
And so, yeah, survivorship bias is 100% a thing.
And no one could have seen which company. I mean, people will tell you that they saw it coming. That's bullshit.
No, I mean, 100%. Like, if I would have chosen Ford in like 1930, it's the only thing I would have talked about. I would have been a genius, right?
Oh my God. That's so true. Oh my. So what else was on that, the report or
the meeting? The
shareholder meeting, yeah.
Man, I've listened to maybe half of it, and so that's about as far as I've gotten.
Okay.
I put it on 1.5 speed because Warren Buffett's cadence is really, really slowed down.
Hell yeah.
He's 90. Charlie Munger's 91, and so really kind of have to like listen for the good parts. Like, obviously, they're some of the best investors of all time, right? You could argue that they're the best 30% year over year for 40 years.
Ridiculous.
Like, if I could do 10. Like a 10-year period, I'd be done, right? Like,
right.
I'd be so happy.
People forget it, man, how good those guys are.
I guess the other thing that they talk about is like choosing companies that are going to perform as well as they have. Does that make sense?
Yeah.
Like choosing individual companies as well as they have over time, it's not as easy as it was in 2020, right? Everybody's always looking for the next big thing. They got lucky a few times, and maybe not even lucky. They looked at the fundamentals. They obviously have a lot of pull when it comes to speaking with companies, and they're able to see a little bit more than we are.
Right.
But it's not as easy as, Twitter's down 10% after earnings come out, so I'm just going to put a ton of money in there. Kathy Wood did it, so like she's right. I'm going to do like the same thing, and I'll be okay. It's not as simple as that, right? You have to have a really long-term vision, and you can look at fundamentals all day. There are a million people, not a million people. There's what, 25,000 CFAs in the world.
Yep.
Right. Yeah. So 25,000 CFAs in the world. If they could choose each and every company, like it would be great. But what I think people don't understand about companies and choosing individual stocks is it's more about the qualitative parts of the company rather than the quantitative.
Right.
Yeah. You can look at numbers all day. You can believe everything that's coming out. But the reality is, everybody's looking at those same numbers, right?
Everyone is. Yeah.
When you look at the qualitative or the, I guess, the intangibles of a company, it's a lot harder to choose something that's going to be around long term.
Yeah.
Really run up the stock price. And, you know, ultimately, I think the goal of every company is to change the world. It's really hard to distinguish between what company is full of BS and then what company is legit.
Right. Yeah, because, like, for me, I feel like in the short run, like, you would argue the stock market's pretty inefficient just with all the volatility from, like, you know, your behavioral biases and all that. But I feel like over the long run, it's actually a lot more efficient than people think because fundamentals tend to drive it. And, yeah, so it's hard to earn a premium over the market in the long run.
Yeah, and, I mean, even looking at Warren Buffett's returns over the past, you know, 20 years, 20, 30 years, he will willingly admit the market is a lot more efficient now than it was 40, 50 years ago when he made a lot of his money. I mean, he was right about Coke. He's bought Coke in, I think, 84.
Yes.
And then he's just let the dividend payments continue to pay out on that. So obviously he knows what he's doing. You can't really go wrong looking at what he's done. So 100%.
Yeah, I totally agree. So what are kind of, has anything shifted on your desk as far as, you know, new outlooks or, you know, are you guys still staying kind of put on where you guys stood in the beginning of the year?
So the innovation strategy, obviously you kind of get kicked in the teeth a little bit. I mean, you can look at Cathie Wood, right? I think their ETF topped out at 155. It was trading at, I think it was 105 earlier, maybe last month, the month before. It slowly started coming back up. But our innovation strategy did kind of take a turn, but we still believe in the companies that we're invested in.
Okay.
Long term. Again, we talked about that earlier in the podcast where, you know, if we have somebody who's retiring in 30 or 40 years, like, okay, there's a little bit of a drawdown, but we had a discussion about what a growth investor was. Like, we had a talk about what we're doing. If your risk tolerance isn't that high, we can certainly move towards our strategic income or our global core. But for the most part, we're just going to ride it out. You know, we'll put some stop losses on things where if it drops 5-10%, like, we'll sell out of it. Just kind of put those safety measures in place. We're not trading options or anything like that. For me today, like, follow a company called Mirage Energy, MRGE. Mm-hmm. It's over the counter. Dropped 10, it's trading at like 29 cents. I personally have a lot of my personal portfolio in it. I love the company. But it dropped 10% today. So it was like, all right, it's not a huge portion of people's portfolio. So added a little bit of it and then put a sell limit on it at like 30 cents. So it's pretty volatile. So if it hits that 30 cents, you know, within the next couple of days, that's a quick 10% that we can make right off the bat. And so, yeah, that's like a small example of something that we're trying to emulate, but we're not gonna do that with our core holdings when it comes to like a Google and Apple and Amazon. We're just gonna hold those for the long term because those are kind of, I mean, those are staple companies within the portfolio.
Are you gonna overweight them even more now, or
It's remained pretty consistent.
Okay.
Over time. And like we were talking about, I guess it was before we were recording, like, everybody wants to be a growth investor and have the 20 to 40% on the upside. But whenever they see like 20% on the downside,
Ron,
like, well, you know, like, what should we sell out? Do you know what you're doing? Like, yes, like, we understand what we're doing. We're investing, you know.
Yeah,
we're not playing the casino. We're not playing craps or poker or whatever. We're investing for the long term. And so understanding that volatility is going to come is incredibly important when working with somebody, especially a money manager, long term.
Yeah.
So from that aspect, it's been good with clients because we can actually understand what their risk tolerance is rather than, you know, in 2020, in April, you talk to somebody and the market's on its way back up. Love growth investing. Like, I want to be in it all. Like, throw me in. I don't know. What's something that had a good run up last year? I can't even think right now. Anyway, Apple. Like, yeah. I guess Apple's a core holding, but
mm-hmm.
What was like a good SPAC last year? I'm trying to think.
CCIV, right?
Sure. Yeah. Even Zoom or like SunPower Energy. We talked about that last year. Or last time we talked, mm-hmm. two times, whatever. Put me in that because I'm a growth investor. Like, I'm ready for it.
Right.
We see all this upside. Then eventually the earnings have to reflect the stock price. And if they don't, the market is very quickly to correct the stock price back to where it should be based off of earnings. And so,
right.
or forward outlook too. And so, I mean, this is just like a quick example of looking at risk tolerance and understanding, you know, what's happening within a portfolio and who actually is a growth investor and who needs to be a little bit more moderate. And in some cases, we do need to be conservative. And I do want to stress that there's nothing wrong with being in one of those three categories, right? A lot of people will hear like, oh, I can't be an aggressive investor, so I'm going to be a moderate or like conservative. And like they kind of, it's like almost you're ashamed of it, right?
Right.
But there's nothing to be ashamed of. Like, it's your risk tolerance, right?
Well, because people have different financial goals too. I mean, it should be driven by goals.
Right, 100%.
Right.
I can't go to the gym and lift 600 pounds, right? Because I'm not like a...
I'm not that strong. Dude. Yeah.
Yeah, and like, that's nothing that I'm ashamed of, right?
Right.
But I understand my limits, and on occasion, I will push them and, you know, kind of look at investing the same way where it's, okay, you're getting more and more, you're more comfortable with being aggressive. Maybe we try to take another step. You don't want to, so let's just stay where we're at. That's kind of the same thought process. You could take behind it.
So, you know, I know we've talked about this in the past, you know, the crypto space, and I know you're somewhat bullish in it, or at least some of the application. So the Coinbase IPO came out, you know, a couple weeks ago, and that was absolutely insane. I was tracking it, and so were you.
Yeah,
and that's probably a good thing for the crypto market. That is viewed as a good thing, right? When you have an exchange of that level. Now, I'm not bullish on Coinbase itself, because I think the model of the margins that they charge on a transaction basis.
Oh, dude, it is.
Oh, it's going to go to zero. It's
going
to
go to
zero.
Yeah.
So it's like, the problem is, and we know this because Robinhood and Webull, they came out, they shrank those margins to zero. So it's Coinbase is going to have to do the same thing, because that market is super saturated with all these new exchanges popping up every day. But it's generally viewed as a good sign. What do you think about those, some of these altcoins? I'm worried about like some of these coins really trashing the movement that's going on. And I know you and I talked about this offline. People are going to blame the market, and they're going to blame cryptocurrencies when some of these altcoins go to shit. They're going to blame the rich people, and they're going to blame the markets, and they're going to blame the Fed. What do you think?
Great question. You summarized it pretty well, right? There's a million different altcoins coming out right now. And I think there's, you can correct me if I'm wrong, 20 to 25,000, like 1,000 different coins on the crypto circuit right now. How many people talk about consistently? Like 3 or 4, right?
Right.
And so the crypto space as a whole, I think there's merit to it. Yes. I would say 50-50.
Oh, yeah, I like that.
Do I think
that.
There's merit to it? Yes. Do I think we might be looking at another dot-com bubble? Maybe so. But that's one of the best things about the market, is you can choose a side, and it's will certainly let you know over the long term. And
the long term, we'll find out. Oh, yeah.
Yeah. With Coinbase IPO, I was excited. I don't know about you, but I was like watching the screen, like checking the ticker every 30 minutes or so. I was like, all right, when is it going to happen? Like, we gotta see. I personally, I thought it was going to double on the first day.
It
I think it debuted at 250.
Yeah.
Went up to four. I think about 400 was the top. Ended the day around 330. And now it's trading around 300. I really did, because it was so anticipated, I thought it might hit 100% in that first day, but I was wrong. When it comes to that compared to other cryptos, especially altcoins, right? I think it was a monumental moment with Coinbase IPOing for the crypto space, saying, hey, we're here, we're legitimate. When you have Dogecoin, which was coded in three or 6 hours.
Yeah.
Very, very quickly. It was coded very quickly.
Well, it's been around for a while, hasn't it? I was reading. It's been around since 2013, right?
But in that same aspect, when you have someone like that shoot up, what was it, 3,000% that week?
Yeah, it was like 3,000.
Something crazy.
Yeah.
Yeah, it was absolutely insane. I think that delegitimizes what Coinbase is trying to do.
Yeah.
So take what you will with that, and hopefully I'm wrong, right? Like, I don't want anybody to like lose a ton of money on Dogecoin or anything in the crypto space. When it comes to it, you know, you're talking about blaming the Fed, you're talking about blaming the government, the man. A lot of people think the stock market's rigged against them.
Right.
You're putting all of your money in alternative assets like crypto and especially like Dogecoin, right? I think there's like legitimacy. You know, 5 to 10 years from now, I think Ethereum, maybe Bitcoin will still be around.
Hell yeah.
I don't know. Dogecoin, I would be very surprised if it was. But if you lose a ton of money in those and you blame the Fed, you blame the government or the man or whatever you want to say, to me, I have a really hard time feeling sorry for people that would lose a lot of money on it, because not taking care of what's tried and true over time, right? Everybody wants the quick return and nobody wants to miss out on, I guess, a movement. I guess you could say that, right?
Like, dude, there's so many movements. Like,
centralized movement, right?
Yeah, it's a centralized movement. It's crazy.
Yeah, if you're concerned about like missing out on that, and you lose a lot of money in the process, I mean, you can turn on Yahoo Finance, you can turn on Bloomberg, you can turn on anything, and hear people saying like, "Don't invest in this. It's not that great." Or if you do, like you had talked about, and I even own your favorite ETF in my portfolio, the Grayscale Bitcoin one, because I can't purchase Bitcoin directly at TD Ameritrade. But if you have it, you know, put it in like 1 to 3% of your portfolio. Don't put all of your savings into something like that where it is speculative. I think we're still in the space where we can say that it is speculative. So, I mean, those are my thoughts on it. You have anything else to add?
Well, I think it just gives, look, there's legitimacy from when you have rich billionaires back it. And I think that's irresponsible. I'm quite frankly pretty frustrated from that standpoint. When you get people like Mark Cuban, I think Mark Cuban's a sellout. I'm just going to say that right now. I think he's
so he's like a I think he's like a wannabe charlatan.
Yeah,
right,
he's a charlatan. He's trying to stay relevant. I know where you got that from, the podcast, right?
Yeah, that's right.
I just think he's a sellout, man, and I think he's trying to stay relevant, and I think it's irresponsible. You know, he's free to say whatever he wants, but I think that delegitimizes who he is as an investor. I think he's a great businessman, but from an investment perspective, I think I lost a lot of respect for someone like him. I don't know.
Right. I think if he wasn't such a big figure, it wouldn't be that big of a deal. Like, nobody cares if I go to my Facebook and talk to my friend, like a few thousand friends, and say, everybody buy Dogecoin. But when you have the reach that he has, and even Elon Musk being called like the Doge father or something like that.
And a lot of people invested because of Elon. They won't admit it,
right?
But you know, there's social there's data that tracks like the social activity, like the Twitter tweets with these cryptos, and there's a high correlation between that return and his tweet activity.
Oh, I'm sure. Yeah, in reality, they can put in a really small amount of their money, right? We're talking, I guess Mark Cuban has 3 or 4 billion. Elon Musk has, I mean, depending on Tesla's stock for the day, you know, over 100 billion. Right. Thing that they put like $1 million into Dogecoin or whatever they said, to us, that's a lot of money. I would love to have $1 million.
Right.
But to them, that's so minuscule. They could lose that and it wouldn't matter to them. I'm sure it hurt, but, you know, long term, like, can make that in a few days.
I still think there's big players holding on to some serious coins. I still think, I was reading about it, I still think there's some big players that are pumping this thing up. It just looks sketchy. Because the thing that worries me is I tried to buy Dogecoin. I didn't talk about this on, I tried to see if I could buy Dogecoin just to see the process. Uh-oh. No, because I was curious. It's actually more difficult than you would think. You have to go through like 3 or 4 different steps. And so I think a lot of this volatility is driven by that scarcity. I know it's like, you know, there's infinite supply, but as far as getting the coins, it's actually more difficult of a process than people think. So I think that's
right, for sure,
large in part why it was, why it's so wild right now. Do you think Coinbase should put Dogecoin on their platform? They're thinking about it.
I think if it... Personally, no, but I'm not going to use Coinbase in order to like purchase anything, so I don't really care either way. But if they want to see themselves as a legitimate, I guess... I feel like they'd be taking a step back if they were to put Dogecoin, because it is such... You know, it's a meme. You know, there's meme stocks, and I guess there's meme coins. Yes, Dogecoin is just like a meme coin. I love all the merch; like, it looks great, and I think it's hilarious. But kind of like treating the stock market like a casino. I think treating the crypto market more like a casino is even scarier. You know, if people are listening and they have Dogecoin, like, I wish them nothing but the best. Like, I really hope Dogecoin does go to the moon, hits like $10, $100. You make a ton of money. Please prove me wrong. But I just want people to understand the risk that they're taking whenever they purchase something like that.
Right. So, you know, I was reading this stat. Look at this. As of March 23rd, so this was a month ago, month and some change, 96% of the slightly more than 3,000 stocks in the Wilshire 5,000 had a positive total return over the prior 12 months, you know, and that hasn't even come close. I mean, that is the highest it's been in over 2 decades.
Yeah.
And when it comes to Gen Z investors, they haven't seen a bear market. So what do you think the impact is going to be on the markets when one does come around? Because these Gen Z investors came in after COVID, a lot of it.
Right. Did. Yeah, and I mean, even with COVID, in that space, last year was such an anomaly. I can't stress that enough. Where you see the market, what did it bottom out at? Was it 30%, 35%
S&P? Like 35%. Yeah.
Yeah, and then it comes up and finishes what, 16% up?
Yeah.
16. Yeah, that is such a huge swing, because when you go down 35%. It's not like you go up 35% and you're back at zero. We've talked about this before too.
Yes.
I don't know what the actual calculation is. I don't think it's a full 70, but to end it up 16% over is absolutely insane, like remarkable. And so if you are starting to invest, and that's the world that you live in, where you just throw money into a stock and it continues to go up, really dangerous game to play, because you don't understand what you're doing, right? You don't understand that you're investing. You see it as a way to, you know, make money. And when I was younger, I kind of thought the same thing. I was like, all right, I'm just going to take a big position. You know, this is when we had like simulators in like high school or whatever. It was like, I'll put like 50% of my portfolio in this one stock, let it go up 10%, and then I'll put a limit on it, sell out of it, and call it a day, and I'll win like the simulation, and that's great. But that's not how the world works, unfortunately. If it was, then I would take all my money and go work on a beach and would never hear from me again, right? So when it comes to addressing Gen Z investors, I mean, the good thing is, I think that they're doing it early on. They're younger, and so they're going to learn how much risk they're willing to take within a portfolio.
Yeah.
Right. The downside of it is probably going to, you know, statistically, and again, please prove me wrong. I don't want anybody to think that like I'm rooting against them, right? Like, please prove me wrong. Statistically, they're probably going to lose money. So luckily, they're doing it at a younger age where their discretionary income isn't as high as it's going to be.
Right.
You had like a 40-year-old who's making $250K a year, and you know they have $50K of discretionary income, and they throw it in a Robinhood, and it turns to $30K overnight. It's another conversation, right?
Right.
And so hopefully they're learning their habits and whether or not they want to trade sooner rather than later. And so then they can decide, do they want to index? Do they want to work with an advisor? What do they want to do long term? Because I think the rate at which people are trading right now is not sustainable.
Right.
Once they get like a full real-time job. And some people may have a full real-time job and they're still able to day trade, and that's great. But I think for the vast majority of people, you're not going to be able to be glued to your phone for, you know, 3 or 4 hours a day while you're at your day job. So,
right.
All that to say, and I keep saying it, people are going to be able to figure out how much risk they want to take, how much money they're willing to risk. And then long term, what it's going to look like when it comes to investing for them, whether that be index funds, working with an advisor, or just doing it on their own.
Right.
One thing that Brandon said last podcast that I really like was there's multiple ways of getting to the top of the mountain.
Yeah.
Just choose yours and stick to that path, and understand that there will be setbacks along the way. But ultimately, whatever that goal is, you're going to have to take those steps to get there.
Yeah, I totally agree. So, you know, one of the last articles I was reading about the generational wealth gap. I don't know if you know anything about that, but it's basically this question is, are younger people worse off today than prior generations? And what they found was baby boomers held a larger portion of like U.S. household wealth in their 30s and 40s compared to current Gen Xers. And they found that. What do you think about that? And what do you do as a Gen Xer or someone like myself to kind of bridge that gap?
Yeah, that's a good question. I haven't seen that study. Man, you should have sent that to me.
I should have.
I think really when it comes to building wealth, and I did a presentation for a company that we run their 401k for last week, and really spoke about how it just takes time.
Yeah.
Right? And Rome wasn't built in a day, and I honestly hate that analogy, but when it comes to investing, like, it's the same thing. Your portfolio, you're very open about it, which is great. You didn't get the amount of wealth that you have just by day trading
Right.
It took diligence, it took patience. And so anybody who is struggling with that thought and is, you know, finds it difficult. One, it is difficult. It is really difficult to see 8% year over year whenever you're looking at people throw money in Dogecoin and, you know, they're like 3,000% in like a few days, right?
That is tough, man.
I'll tell you from the institutional side, it is very frustrating to see, right? Because we're doing a lot of quantitative research, doing our due diligence on the qualitative research as well. And then you see some coin with a little dog on it,
and they're crushing you.
And then they're like crushing me. It's like, all right, well, you know, so I'll say it. Sometimes my job is really hard.
Yeah,
you know,
yeah, that's hard.
I will 100 like 1,000% admit sometimes my job is really tough. But I love what I do, right? I can't complain. But when it comes to generational wealth, things like that, take time. That's a really unsexy answer. Do find your way up the mountain, like we talked about earlier, and continue to go through it, even if it does seem frustrating at the time. You're frustrated through the process, understanding that the habits that you establish when you're young are really going to pay off whenever you're older. And that's really the best advice that you can give. Following stuff like, I love the content that you put out, Josh, like shameless plug for Wall Street Junkie, right?
Yeah.
You don't want to pay somebody to do it. Just index, like there's no shame in doing that. And if you want to trade, like have a little something on the side, but the majority of your money should be in your employer sponsored plan if you have one.
Yeah.
And letting that sit and grow over time, being patient with it. You change jobs, moving into a traditional or Roth IRA, manage it yourself. Just understand that over time, especially whenever you hit like the 100K mark, that's when wealth really starts to compound upon itself. So yeah, really unsexy answer, but that's the best one I got.
When are you hitting, the 6-figure mark in your portfolio? I know we talked about this last time.
That's a good question. I don't know. So right now I'm in like growth stage of business building.
Yeah.
And so I am a 1099 contractor at Iron Oak Wealth. And so like I have my own LLC at the side where I get paid for like tax purposes and stuff. And a lot of like my discretionary income is like more towards office build out and things like that. And so I am kind of taking like a step back when it comes to investing and like figuring things out from like a personal finance standpoint. But let's see, maybe by 30, 31, okay. I think that'd probably be like a reasonable goal of hitting 6 figures. But, you know, do you anticipate like my personal income to go up significantly within the next like 3 or 4 years? And so, yeah, I mean, it's coronavirus was a kind of its own meeting people and trying to get them to work with you during coronavirus was, I mean, impossible, right? It's like, hey, you want to hop on a Zoom and we can talk about your personal finances for an hour?
Right.
Bro, if I got that, it's like, my answer is hell no, I don't want to do that. Like, I want to worry about like what's happening with my family and trying to keep my job and like all these other things going on, you know? And so now that things are opening back up, like, I'm vaccinated, I can go in like talk to people and I would say 30 to 31 is probably a reasonable goal for, you know, okay, 6-figure portfolio.
So savings rates are super freaking elevated. Do you guys have a take on that at your office? You know, they're like double or triple what they've been in the last 10 years. What's your take on that? What are we going to see it come out in the market?
Yeah, that's that is something that I've heard a lot about on Animal Spirits. They talk about that maybe like every 2 weeks or so. When it comes to it coming out within the market, I think so. I can be completely wrong when it comes to this, but I think a lot of people have been inside for a really long time, and that airlines are starting to open up, travel's opening up. People are really actually able to travel fully vaccinated. CDC says it's okay. I think that's when, you know, it's pun intended, things are really going to take off, right?
Yeah.
So we'll see. I mean, either that or people are trying to save up for a down payment on a house right now. I know in California, it's crazy. In Texas, Austin is absolutely insane.
I looked at median home price in Austin, dude. It is actually, you would say, comparable to where I'm at living currently.
No way.
Yeah. Holy no hell. Shit. Yep. I looked and I was like, oh yeah, you guys are like 25,000 or so below where we're at. Wow. So if you think Texas is cheap, guys, it's not in Austin. I can tell you that much right now.
Yeah. So I'm in like starting to look at like, I mean, you know, 5 to 6 years down the road, like just buying land up in like Liberty Hill or Cedar Park or like, you know, even Cedar Park. Like I'm in the suburbs of Austin. And you know, going a little bit north and just like buying a bunch of land and building a house on it seems a little bit more reasonable than trying to get anything within like 20 miles of the city. But
sure,
see what happens. You think a housing market crash is coming?
No.
What do you think?
It's not happening. Not happening.
to get into existence.
And I'll link it in the Spotify. Well, I know you listen to the same podcast. Dude, I just think there's so much institutional money flooding in, right, which is another thing. But I think the big thing that, and I know this for a fact, builders are still scared, right? There's a housing shortage. Dude. They talk about in that podcast, crazy, like 3.8 million houses too short. But with that, builders got really burned in 08. They got really burned. And because of that, supply is super slow. It still is right now. Like in my, where I live, the new build site I live in, they have a list of people that want to buy 70 deep, and they only release 3 to 4 homes at a time.
Holy cow. Yeah. Yeah. That's insane. Yeah. And I think also lenders are much more stringent when it comes to who they're allowing to get a loan compared to 2008. Right. Yeah. And so yeah, I think they said it on the podcast, like there's no big short two coming.
No, people say that. It's like, no, dude, I was in the space. There's nothing like that. Freddie and Fannie have their shit together.
I think it might like cool off a little bit, or at least that might just be my hope.
Yeah, it'll cool off a little bit. I just don't think it's going to be like a drastic sell-off.
Yeah, I don't think we're going to see like 2008 numbers where houses dropped like 50%.
It was 50%, dude.
Banks and foreclosures happening, or banks buying them and foreclosures happening all over and over again. I don't see that happening. I know a lot of people are scared of the forbearance. Is it forbearance? Yeah, forbearance right now. So maybe I'll be able to like, I mean, this is kind of bad to say, but maybe I'll be able to like scoop in and like pick someone up then. But
maybe. Banks, we'll see what happens.
I don't know.
Banks keep pushing forbearance down the road, man, because banks got hurt when they did foreclosures too. They got hurt holding the bag. So they don't really want to do it. They just want to kick it, and they're trying to help these borrowers out as much as they can. I'm curious to see. So I'm looking at average millennial net worth by age. We're both 20. We're both 26, right? You're 25 or 26?
I'm 25, yeah.
Okay. What do you think the average net worth of a 25-year-old is?
Is it positive?
Well, I don't know. You go. You guess.
I'm going to say, man, maybe like I'll say negative 10,000.
Negative 23.
No way. Yeah. Holy cow, man. This is alarming.
It is, right?
I think that's mostly like student loans. Is that a median or average?
Yeah, so yeah, that's average. So
okay.
But they say yeah, that's average. Yeah.
Okay. I mean, but still, like that's
ridiculously low.
Like kind of threw that number out there just like to see, but man, that's pretty wild. So you're doing very well for yourself. Congratulations.
Well, I think, well, sure. But I think it's important to note on this podcast, there's a lot of people out there that don't have any student debt, and they have zero net worth, and they look at that as a negative. But guys, I'm telling you right now, like even if you have nothing to your name, no debt, mm-hmm, no assets, you are better than the average person your age. That I can guarantee you.
Yeah.
I mean,
yeah.
The average net worth of a 39-year-old is only $70,000. 39.
Wow. Yeah. Well, I mean, do what Josh tells you to do here, and you can certainly pass that up pretty quickly.
No, because it matters. I mean, your earnings matter too, I think.
Oh, absolutely. Yeah.
I mean, you can get there, like you said. There's a number of ways to get up the mountain, but easiest and quickest way is earn more and invest more. Don't spend that more.
Yeah, I think that's something that's not addressed as well. It's like, oh, well, you should just save a lot of money. It's like, well, you should like have a job to where you're able to like do it. And obviously it's not that easy. I don't want to like oversimplify it, but there might be sacrifices that you have to make in order to get there. And that's another conversation. But yeah. You got anything else for me, man? You got any other questions?
That's it, man.
Sweet, man.
Well, yeah, I appreciate your time.
Dude, always fun. Always fun hopping on the podcast.
I'll get this one.
What's your company recommendation these days? Who do you like?
I still think banks.
Yeah.
Yeah.
fintech or traditional?
Traditional banks. Yeah.
I think as soon as like interest rates kind of start going up, they're going to really skyrocket.
Fuck yeah. I'm a big fan of B of A. I'm a big fan of JP Morgan.
Yay, man. It's like I'm talking to Warren Buffett right here. Loves Bank of America.
I know, right? Doesn't he? But I'm odd. What about you? What's your biggest stock?
Biggest stock
that you're most bullish on?
Biggest stock in like my portfolio, I guess like our portfolio.
As always, my money crazed lunatics. Stay hungry. Keep grinding. Thanks for tuning in. Catch you on the next one. Peace.